Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss his new work on beer tasting. This is Beersmith Podcast number 182.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 182, and it's late November 2018. This week, Randy Mosher joins me to discuss his new work on beer tasting and self-awareness. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's a podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It also has an integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new whirlpool options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Randy Mosher. Randy is author of many of my favorite brewing books, including Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. Randy is also a faculty member at the Seibel Institute and partner in two Chicago breweries, Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root. Randy, it is fantastic to have you back on the show.
Great to be here again, Brad.
So how are things up there in Chicago? Did you shovel away the snow this week?
We really missed, we dodged the bullet this time around. We got a little bit of dusting. We had some sort of wet, gloppy, just some sprinkles. Haven't had the big one yet. So
it'll awesome. Come. Yeah, it's coming. Chicago especially, you know. Well, we last had you on episode number 169, talking about hop biotransformations. Yeah. What have you been up to since then? What have you been doing?
Well, I'm actually working on trying to put a book together right now. This idea to take people into the sensory realm and really kind of show them how messed up we all are, you know, in terms of we kind of think we're in charge of our own simple little selves and that we determine our fate and that we know what we're doing. And that when you actually start studying the sensory system, you find out that there's a lot of really curious stuff going on. And there's a lot of things that our brain does for us without us really getting involved in it directly. So it's pretty fascinating. You know, ultimately, I want everybody to be a better taster. But I think if you pursue tasting, what's cool is that you really can learn a lot about yourself and learn about how you're put together and stuff. So that's been pretty interesting to read the scientific papers and start putting it all together for people. So we're just shopping it around to publishers and we'll see where we end up. But hopefully we'll have a book out about a year and a half from now, I would guess.
So this is the early preview then, huh?
Yeah, it's just I'm just digging up stuff and thought it'd be kind of fun to share it with people.
Well, you start with an assertion that every person's beer perception is a unique experience, which I find interesting. We don't all perceive things the same, even when it comes to beer.
Or anything. So you know, one of the really interesting things is that our genome devoted to olfaction and aroma is 1% of our whole DNA, right? So that's more DNA than we are different from chimpanzees. So we have about 1,000 known genes for olfaction. About half of those are unexpressed, which means they're sitting there in the background, waiting in case the evolutionary situation changes and we need to pull those back out and put them to use again. So when you have that many genes, you have a lot of variation within your gene. You have about 26 or 28 genes devoted to tasting bitterness, for example. And there's one gene in particular called the TAS2R gene that we typically have three copies of. And they are the genes, the type of bitterness that we encounter with broccoli and cabbage and things like that. That people who really hate broccoli, they hate it because they call them super tasters. It's a little oversimplified as it's usually presented, but there are certain people who are very highly sensitive to compounds that can be found in those kind of green vegetables, that they perceive them a lot more bitter, as being a lot more bitter and also a lot less pleasant than, say, people who like IPAs.
And so how you said there's 1,000 genes roughly. How do those manifest themselves when we start talking about differences in taste or perception?
So you've got, and that's 1,000 genes for olfaction. And like I said, about half of those are expressed and half of those, meaning that they're active, that they code for particular types of receptors that can be found in our noses. And so those with 400 different genes, that's a lot of opportunity for things to kind of go funny, right? To be different from person to person. And in addition to that, you're not strictly, your being as a taster is not only about DNA, because your cultural experiences, the things you had as a child, the foods that you loved, the medicines that you hated, or whatever bad experiences you had with certain foods, all that stuff stays with you, right? So we've grown up in a culture that has certain things that's very different from somebody who grows up in rural Korea, for example. You know, that their tastes, their preferences, the things that they're familiar with, the things they regard as unfamiliar and or alien would be different than ours. So it's really this combination of our lived experience plus the genes that we have built into us, and it creates a lot of variation from person to person.
So give me some examples of how this might manifest itself, either in taste or smell.
Well, sure. The one thing I always advise people to do if they want to become tasters is to get out there and judge some beer. And we could talk about judging later because I know it's on your list. But one of the things about tasting and judging in a really formal type of situation like that is that you're sitting at the table approaching the same beers blindly that other people are. And you really find out how differently you perceive things than they do. And so that's one of the beauties of being involved in judging, is that you have that ability to see where you're at. So for example, I've got friends who are really super tasters on buttery, on a chemical called diacetyl. That's a product of fermentation that normally, under normal conditioning in beer making, will be absorbed back into the yeast and converted into something that's not particularly aroma active. I've got a friend who's super sensitive to iron aroma, and by the same token, you'll find people who are very not sensitive to certain kinds of compounds. There's a compound that smells like mashed potatoes, I am told, called methionine, and I have a really hard time smelling methionine. I'm just a bit blind to it. But on the other hand, I'm kind of a super smeller on musty, moldy flavors. So I'm one of those people that doesn't really like beets very much because they smell like my grandfather's basement. I have great fond memories of my grandfather's basement, but not to eat. So those are just the kinds of things. You know, I think when you start looking at the vocabulary of beer and the number of different flavor compounds that a beer expert ought to be able to identify, probably somewhere around a couple of dozen or so, and there's maybe another couple of dozen that you should be able to at least recognize the characteristic of it or put it in a certain category. And so, as the more experience you get to learn which things you're sensitive to and which ones are not. If you were to go to work for Anheuser-Busch or Miller or even one of the large craft breweries and get trained as a panelist, one of the things they would do is work with you to develop your tasting profile, which means they would train you on a number of these different compounds presented in, squirted into beer, a spiked beer, and bring the levels down and down and down till they found where your personal threshold would be. And then that eventually gets plugged into your computerized profile as a taster. And so there may be aspects of beer that you are either too sensitive to or not sensitive enough. And those would kind of go in your profile, and that would be taken into account when they're trying to evaluate your scoring.
So that gives them the ability to normalize the scores, I guess, right?
I think so. Yeah, that's about as much as I understand about it right now.
Yeah.
I'm not really involved in those very sophisticated taste panels. It's something I'm interested in, and I'll probably be digging into for the purposes of this project.
Well, despite the varying taste thresholds and all the other chemical reactions and history going on, we still can, even the average among us can still pick up a sort of a dizzying number of aromas and flavors, right?
Yeah, the exact number is not exactly known. The number that's usually put forth that everybody kind of agrees is 10,000 aromas. There was somebody that did a study about 5 years ago, and they concluded that we can detect between 1 and 1,000 trillion different aroma combinations. But then, because this is science, there's some more papers out there on the internet saying, no, that guy got all the math wrong. It's not nearly that much. But what's fascinating is that we only have 400 or 500 different genes for aroma, meaning we have 400 or 500 different types of olfactory sensors, right? But each sensor can integrate and send signals from a number of different types of chemicals. And any given chemical can plug into multiple types of aroma sensors, of olfactory sensors. And so what those things do is that each different chemical that gets locked into a sensor and fires that signal in a somewhat different way. And the signals all go to your brain to a part called the olfactory bulb, and that olfactory bulb actually presents this map of aromas that are sort of organized by chemical type and also organized to some degree by how much you like them or don't like them as a general rule. So like all the esters, for example, are kind of in the same part of this map. And the less pleasant chemicals are off in another part of the map. And so your brain looks at that pattern, that sort of map of responses to these different chemicals, and interprets that using the same type of neural system that we use to detect faces. So aromas are kind of like you don't get them, and you're smelling something, and then all of a sudden you'll get this. It's like you're walking up to a friend on the street, and when they're two blocks away, you can't really tell who they are. But they get to a certain point, and they get close enough, and it's like, oh yeah, there's Brad there, you know, hey Brad. But it's that snap of recognition that happens with aroma, and that's why. But it's a pretty fascinating process, and it's incredibly complicated. The more you look into the brain, the more amazing it really is.
And then the brain also kind of mixes in mouthfeel and flavor and, like you said, history and experiences as well, right?
It's a really, really complicated mix. One thing I'm just finding out, I was just reading a paper yesterday, is that mouthfeel, the so-called trigeminal stimulus, things like minty cool and chili heat and some other textural kinds of things, are directly connected, very closely connected to olfaction. In fact, seem to be more closely connected to olfaction than they are to taste, even though they're going on in your mouth. And the reason that they're there and the reason that they're seems like the reason they're there is that they are, again, one more warning sign for things that might hurt us and one more positive sign about things that may be good for us. And so they're connected with the olfactory system, what they call the peripheral, which means right out there, pretty close to where the sensors are. But they're also connected to the olfactory system in the central, which means up higher up in the brain, once you've already processed it through your limbic system, where the emotion and memory is stored. And once it gets up to your cognitive brain, they're connected again. And so it's this place called the piriform cortex that seems to be the spot in your brain that starts to really put all these different things together, to take mouthfeel, to take taste and aroma, and put them all together and create something called flavor. And flavor also incorporates, again, your personal experience. If you have an expectation, if you have a personal experience with vanilla, in which vanilla is always associated with things that are sweet, if you put vanilla in your mouth, which is actually bitter, even without sugar, you're going to have a kind of a sweet flavor sensation, just because that's in your history now. And your brain kind of tends to go along with what the history is, and because that's generally what's made sense to you in the past. So it's not necessarily always looking now for new and different things.
So this is how, say, the 10,000 different aromas suddenly become perhaps millions of flavors, right?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, I would take a wild guess that the number of different flavors is sort of limitless, because it involves so much emotional stuff. It involves all this olfaction and taste and mouthfeel. You've got a lot of different inputs plus the history. So it'd be very hard to actually try and characterize that and do a study to see if you could figure that out. So I don't know. There may be some things that remain forever unknown. I don't know.
Well, maybe it goes back to your original thesis, which is, you know, it's sort of unlimited. It's sort of each person's experience is unique when they taste something, right?
Well, it's unique and it changes over time too.
Yeah, that makes sense, because we already talked about the history. Well, let's dive in for a minute into taste, which is, many people argue, is one of our most simple senses. You know, you're limited to the five basic flavors: salty, bitter, sweet, sour, and savory or umami. But I guess there's more to the story with that, right?
Yeah, a lot more. Well, I mean, there are a fairly limited number of things that our taste sensors respond to. So there's 28 total different taste sensors. Sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami. There's another one called kokumi that's kind of related to umami, maybe physiologically, cellularly, somehow intertwined with it. It's not completely understood. It does appear that fat is a taste sensor, is a taste. Some other things, possibly carbonation, some metallic things definitely trigger kind of a taste sensation. But, you know, and taste is really the first sense. Like, bacteria have taste, right? Because and what's interesting, you know, one of the things that's been fascinating to me is how directly connected our senses are to creating action, right? They're designed for rapid response, and in bacteria, these taste sensors are actually hardwired to the little motors that drive motion. So, you know, bacteria doesn't really have a nervous system because it's a single cell, right? It has little, you know, it has some sort of wiring inside and these different proteins that do things, but there is no nervous system. So that if bacteria smells something it likes, it'll turn the little screw on its propeller one direction and move towards it. And if it finds a chemical that it doesn't like, something that might indicate a toxin of some sort, it'll turn that little propeller the other way and move away from it. And so, you know, when you look at that, it helps understand, like, the purpose of the sensory system is to give you information about what you should have and what you shouldn't have. And in fact, another little tidbit I picked up recently is that one of the reasons, well, if you put sweet and bitter in your mouth at the same time, mm-hmm. This is something you could do in beer tasting, for example. So bitter beer and sweet desserts work really great together because the bitterness really will knock that sugar out. And to some degree, the bitter or the sweetness sort of counteracts the bitterness. But one thing that's going on in your tasting system is that bitterness takes precedence over sweetness because sweet's a nutritional thing. It can wait unless you're just absolutely starving, right? So, but bitterness might be a poison, and that has to happen right now. And so when you put bitter and sweet in your mouth, your brain actually prioritizes bitter over sweet and allows that sweet sensation to kind of fade and you keep your attention on the bitter compound. So again, this is sort of how we're put together, you know, that we've got all these systems that prioritize and enhance contrast and ignore certain things. So there's just a lot of stuff going on kind of under the surface. It's really pretty interesting to me.
And you mentioned earlier, there's some other things going on with bitterness too, in terms of the way it's perceived and the ability of different people to perceive it, right?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of hubbub around in the media maybe 10 years ago about so-called super tasters. And so some people, because we have this variation in our genes, people noticed that there were a couple of particular compounds that they could put on people's tongues, and some people would be really sensitive to it, and other people couldn't taste it at all. And that showed up and then some people found it moderately bitter. So what they came up with is where about 25% of people who they called super tasters, who were pretty sensitive to this chemical called PROP, I think it's called. And then another 25% of people who could barely taste it at all. And then the middle 50% of people that found it, yeah, it's kind of bitter, but it's not that annoying. But the people who found it really bitter found it also really unpleasant. And they are generally people who don't like a lot of vegetables, especially cruciferae, you know, broccoli and Brussels sprouts. They probably tend to be people that don't drink IPAs. They may not like red wine. They may prefer sweet wine. But again, we've got a lot of variation in all of our senses. When they've studied people with regard to their sweet taste, that varies quite a bit. So there's a lot of variation in there. The other thing that's really interesting about taste sensors is that we don't just use them for tasting, right? We've got taste sensors in our bones. We got bitter receptors in our bones. We got sweet receptors kind of all over our body. We got bitter receptors all the way through our gut. And those we don't sense directly, but they are connected to our hormonal system. And they're connected to systems that will affect our metabolism and our state of hunger and satiation and things like that. So a lot of people who are studying obesity are looking at things like leptin, which is one of these hormones related to hunger and satiation. And the other thing that's really crazy is that it appears that bacteria have taste sensors too, and that bacteria in our gut and possibly in our mouth also can actually change our metabolism and in ways send out hormonal signals to us that our body can interpret to help get the bacteria more of what they want, right? So in some ways, we may have been hijacked by bacteria that use us to their own ends and have us feed them. So, you know, we're kind of like kidnapped by little tiny aliens. It's pretty amazing to think about.
And there's chemistry going on here too, right? As we're tasting and smelling things.
Well, it's all chemistry. So, you know, wherever that goes, you know, one of the things I've been really interested in is trying to put together a rainbow of aroma, you know, and you've seen color wheels before, you know, in the new version of Tasting Beer, I did a flavor spiral because I didn't really want to confuse it with like the wheel of beer, you know, the taste wheel or aroma wheel of beer. But the actual picture turns out to be pretty complicated. And as I said, that it's likely that the very first type of categorization our brain does on aroma is to say whether we like it or not. So is this nice? Is this awful? Right. So when you first smell stuff, it's so different than vision, right? So if you think about looking out and you're out in the country and you're looking out in the woods and it's a beautiful day and the trees are green and you look out and you think, yeah, those are green, that's a green, there's a red thing there, there's a blue thing there, sky's blue, bam, 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 you got that nailed. The emotional content comes later. Oh, yeah, I'm feeling really mellow. This is a beautiful scene I'm looking at. But with aroma, it's the reverse, right? Because, again, your visual system does a lot of different things for you. But your olfactory system is really there to detect friend or foe, harmful things versus friendly things. So it makes sense that those things are that the emotional content, that the action kind of comes first and the rationale comes a little bit later. Pretty cool to think about it. So for example, fruity aroma, that's a generally classic chemicals called esters. And those are all kind of grouped together in the olfactory cortex in this flavor map that we have in our heads. So those things in any given rainbow of color, those would all be there together. But then you sort of have other different chemical groups that some of them are that smell like dead bodies. Some of them smell like body odor. Some of them smell like all number of wonderful and awful things. And our brain really makes that classification by how well it likes things.
So, I mean, since this pattern matching, at least the initial round, gets done fairly low in the brain functions, does that mean we later go back and somehow rationalize the pattern that we found? It was good, bad perception we had?
Well, no, we don't rationalize it. We feel it. And you've got to really think about it to make that conclusion. Oh, I smelled a chocolate brownie. That must have made me happy. But by that point, you're just thinking about it, and you were happy. Really happy moments ago before you started wasting your time thinking about how happy you were, if that makes any sense.
So how does our brain then handle a mix of things? You take something like an IPA, it's got floral notes, it's got malty notes, it's got bitterness in it. How does our brain try and handle that mix of flavors?
Well, I guess that depends on what you're trying to do. You know, if you're out in the pub drinking with your friends, it's just like, man, this beer's tasting really good. And you don't really have to give it any more thought than that. You know, as a taster, we want to really kind of deconstruct that, right? So you're going to try and ignore those signals about whether you like it or not, because that's maybe not the most important point. Well, it's an important point, but we want more of ourselves as a taster. So we're going to try and go through and really deconstruct that beer. And I think when you get some experience behind you, and you've had experience not just with tasting, but with formulating beer, and you understand the flavors that ingredients can get, you can kind of do a pretty good job of pulling a beer apart and looking for the things that build that make that beer what it is. And so you can evaluate a beer from just purely a flavor standpoint and kind of categorize the types of fruitiness in there, and sometimes even a particular molecule like the banana smelling isoamyl acetate or a pineapple or apple-y kind of ester aroma in there. And then also think about the types of malt character in there, anywhere from bready to caramel to nuts to toast to roast to chocolate to espresso. And then you kind of characterize, okay, what's going on in this beer? Maybe look for some yeast character too that may add some aromatics to it, to either, again, fruitiness or not fruitiness in the case of a lager beer. And then, of course, you're always looking for off flavors. So does this beer have things going on in it that it shouldn't have going on, right? Does it have buttery smells? Does it have DMS or some other sulfur compounds? Does it have too much ester? And then you start to get into questions about, does this beer match the style description, right? So every brewer just about puts something on the label to help consumers understand, what am I drinking here? an IPA. Everybody understands the general outlines of what an IPA is, or we did before the New Englands came along anyway.
At least you have an expectation, right?
You have an expectation. And as a brewer, I mean, you can not use those terms, but in the end, somebody's got to write something on a chalkboard. You know, when you've got a beer on draft, and you bet it's easier to work with that system than not work with the system, because people will just make up any old thing that kind of feel like they have to have something that they can grasp to hold on to, that they know what they're getting. And of course, when you're judging a competition, that's a lot of the judging is determining how much of an IPA this IPA is, or how close to what the style category guidelines are for a Belgian double or a Doppelbock or a triple or a wheat beer or whatever, you know, whatever kind of beer. So that's a sort of, it's very much higher level, you know, that's cognitive work. That's not sensory work. After the initial impression and kind of understanding the flavors, now you got to really make an educated calculation about, you know, kind of referring to the models in your head that you've gotten based on experience, plus what you know about what the style guidelines actually say in writing. And then now you're trying to match that to the beer in your in your hand. Does this match? Does it not match? Is it in the style or out of the style? So that's a crucial thing in judging also.
So I mean, I understand the importance of deconstruction when you're judging beer, but what about just sitting back and enjoying a beer for what it is?
I think once you learn to taste, it's really kind of fun to do that. And, you know, I'm still involved with breweries and get involved in the recipes. And I just always want to know what other people are up to, you know? So for me, it's kind of a game of tasting beers and seeing how other people put beers together. Do I like this idea? Is this kind of an interesting combination? Is this just like straight classic? Has somebody got a change up here that's interesting? How's the balance? Do all the parts work together? Does it create one whole thing? Are there layers there? Can I peel that apart? So for me, it's like, I don't know, you know, some people get into something and then the pursuit can spoil the unadulterated pleasure of it.
Yeah, I'm thinking I often go to these events and I go out with Gordon Strong, who's arguably one of the best beer judges in the world. And Gordon is fun to sit with, but he tends to pick the beers apart pretty quickly. So you're sitting there enjoying a beer with a meal or whatever, and he starts picking apart and you start tasting things that you weren't tasting before, you know. Yep. And it can kind of ruin the mood, sort of.
Well, you got to know where to turn it off.
Yeah. So. That comes under my next question, though. Beer is not just the taste and the aroma. It's actually judged in the context of the sights, the sounds, the venue that you're at, the foods that you're tasting. Oh, sure. And of course, you talked about the importance of your own flavor history or food history.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
So what role do those things play?
Well, here's an example of how, like, just again, how surprising all of this is. Noise and sound affects the way you taste and smell. So I help Ray Daniels with the Cicerone program by coming out and being one of the examiners that does the exams for the Master Cicerones. And as part of that, all of us who are doing it, us professionals, are tasting along with the candidates on their taste sensory panels.
Sure.
So, you know, get a tray with 9 samples in it. And depending upon what the task is, you know, normally we'll go through and kind of identify that. So we were at a brew pub about 4 in the afternoon doing the last panel of the day. And they had the music going in the pub. It was sort of raucous, rock and roll, a little bit loud. You know, we didn't really think that much of it, but we got these trays out in front of us. And every single one of us was like, I can't smell anything. I don't know how we're supposed to do this. It's like there's plugs up my nose. And then it's like, I wonder what would happen if we had them turn off that music. And so we had them turn the music way down, and it was just like flipping a switch. It came right back. And it appears, so then it's like, okay, here's another paper to look for. So it appears that olfaction and what you hear can interfere with one another. And certainly noise can interfere with olfaction. There's a famous story about people on an airline testing out wine for the first class section in the on the airline, and they tasted the wines on the ground, and the wines tasted great. And then they took them up on an airplane, and the wines tasted like crap. And it's like, wonder what's going on there. So they went back to the ground and put themselves in a depressurized chamber and suck the air out like they do on airplanes up to 10,000 feet. And it's like, no, that really wasn't it. And so then they recreated the noise of the jet engines on the airplane. And it turns out that was enough to dull the flavor of that wine. So, you know, sometimes things that you might think of as kind of inconsequential can really change the experience for you.
And what about things like food or even the venue you're at?
Well, the venue, yeah. I mean, obviously, we're in a world, pretty much a no-smoking world, but that was always like the big thing with tasting is make sure people aren't smoking. When you judge beer, they always warn you not to wear any kind of cologne or perfume or scented hair products or anything like that. I know at the Great American Beer Festival, one of the chemical companies supplies some unscented hand soap so the judges don't have their hands coated, you know, with funny smelling chemicals when they're trying to judge beer. The other thing that's really that you kind of have to think about quite a lot as a judge is your eyes can be really deceptive. And it's a bigger problem in the wine world because people have an expectation that the color and the darkness of the wine is going to give them a lot of information. And it may or may not, but it certainly doesn't line up with what the olfactory experience is always going to be. Because you can have a really big wine that's actually fairly pale in color. And you can have the opposite too, and have a really dark wine that's really doesn't have all that much aroma going on. So I know in wine, sometimes they'll judge in a black glass. We generally don't do that in beer, but you have to be careful when you're judging, because if you put a little bit of black malt coloring in a beer, you can make a pretty dark beer and it'll still taste like a pretty pale color. But because your brain is kind of wired, the problem with our visual system is it tends to be a bully, because it's the one that's on all the time. When we're awake, it's on and we're watching, you know, so it has a very high priority, but it's kind of stupid in terms of being a taster. It really doesn't add much to the process and really can detract from it. So it's something I think as a taster, you kind of have to ignore pretty much, unless the beer is just ghastly ugly or really heavily sedimented.
Little bits floating in it and stuff.
But that doesn't happen that often.
So. No. Well, one challenge we always run into when we're judging or tasting or sensing or smelling is that we simply lack the vocabulary to describe what we're experiencing.
It's true. We're pretty good at describing color, for example. We got a lot of words on color. But our vocabulary, just the amount of words that we have to choose from, is really, really limited. And they've done studies on people who are living as hunter-gatherers in various parts of the world. And what they found is that these hunter-gatherers who are out there in the forest all day, every day, have a lot more words to use to describe aromas generally than we do. You know, we have aroma, most of our aroma language we use is referential. We say, oh, it smells like, and then it smells like a mango. It
smells
or a
like food,
or,
yeah, some kind of food.
But it doesn't smell like we can think it smells good or it smells bad. But, you know, does it smell waxy? Does it smell like, are there general words? And our language is really, really limited in that. Whereas people in these other, more tribal type of societies that are still living as living off the land, not doing agriculture, they've got this richer vocabulary. And it turns out that those same people, when you'll have one part of the tribe that's now settled down and start farming, they lose their vocabulary pretty quickly because they don't really have a need for it. They have their brain, you know, the brain is incredibly adaptable. And if it's taking up energy and time and space in there doing stuff that's no longer needed, it'll just drop it. And so,
I mean, when I go to if I go to the pub with some friends and start talking about diacetyl and DMS and all this other stuff, they have no idea what I'm talking about either.
Well, that's a real, I mean, that's very specific learned vocabulary that we, that we use. But the thing is, the thing about it is we're just not structured to create language out of emotion, right? Again, our sensory system, chemosenses are designed to create action. Action requires emotion because emotion drives behavior. And so we go through the amygdala, the hippocampus, where memory is stored, and then eventually it sort of wanders its way up to the piriform complex, and then eventually it gets into parts of our brain where we can actually think about it. But it's a long and arduous journey, and we're not really very, you know, we're just not that good at it. You know, as a taster, you know, we have these little memory flashbacks, right? So that's your amygdala, really your hippocampus is sort of the main control center for memories, I guess you'd say, in the brain. And, you know, we all have these experiences when you smell a smell, it transports you to someplace else in your history, maybe your childhood or maybe more recently. But those little memories are really great places to stay because that's your brain trying to tell you something. And if you can stay in those memories, if you can figure out what it is or learn that sometimes it's not even a complete memory, it's just all of a sudden a word pops into your head for no apparent reason. We were tasting champagne and Nancy said, picked up a glass and she said, horseradish, which is kind of a weird thing to say at a champagne tasting, but you know, she's learned not to filter herself. And when we smelled it, it's like, yeah, it has maybe a little bit of cork taint, you know, that the chemical called TCA that smells like a musty carpet and is from contaminated cork.
That's what spoils a lot of beer, a lot of wines, right?
Well, in a champagne cork, you have those granular corks. And so it may have only been one tiny little grain of that rather than a full-on cork taint, but it had just enough along with whatever sort of spicy character was in that grape to put those two things together. And her brain recognized that and triggered this horseradish thing. So it, those two things together just sort of popped up and triggered this memory, which then we could go back and evaluate and start to break it down, you know, and that's sort of the process when you're tasting, you just want to never filter, and whatever dumbass thing pops into your head, just shout it out and you can think about it later. And even that act of coming out through your mouth, words coming out of your mouth, going back into your ears, that creates a different kind of neural circuitry that may help you understand it in a different way. So that's a real insight. It took me years to kind of figure that out, but anybody can do that. You don't have to be a sophisticated taster. Just don't filter yourself. Just let it all hang out.
Well, in your outline, you have a section labeled the dopamine rush of whales, which caught my eye. What exactly is that?
Well, we're in this new world with beer, right? Where it's not just a beverage, not something just to enjoy with friends. It's not something just to soothe yourself or enjoy on a hot summer's day. It's a prize, right? So we have multiple different kinds of neurotransmitters in our heads floating around. And in this particular case, the neurotransmitter is dopamine. And dopamine is a chemical that is involved with like the reward system of the brain, the pleasure and reward system of the brain. So people that have addictions to harmful drugs, that's often a dopamine driven behavior because the drug will give them a dopamine rush, which is crazy pleasurable. And then eventually that wears off and they need to get that pleasurable hit again. And every time they do, it takes a little more to do it, a little more to do it. Obviously, people get into pretty serious trouble with that kind of thing. So It's just the same way for people who pursue stamp collecting or Pokemon cards or rare wine or whatever it is.
Beer bottle collecting?
Beer bottle collecting, yeah, absolutely. I got a few right on the shelves behind me.
I can see some behind you, actually.
Some mezcals here. You know, I'm a dopamine-driven guy to some extent. I've been a collector since I was in kindergarten, and I like that. But I think, you know, for a lot of us in the brewing industry, it's great that people like our beer to the point where they'll stand in line and wait for it. But it's also a little disturbing to see beer treated as this object of lust that's sort of somehow disconnected from its real purpose as a sensory item. But you know, whales, of course, is just the term that people use to describe beers that are relatively unobtainable. You know, it's just a slang term for something giant. And
the great white whale, I guess, Melville.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, I just thought that'd be kind of a cute title for a chapter to kind of explore all this about collecting and this sort of reward system and how that manifests itself, again, through beer, like everything does if you look hard enough.
So you're kind of a Captain Ahab in all this, right?
You know, I wouldn't go that far, but...
Well, I wanted to finish and have you talk about tasting and judging beer and what's the right way to actually approach it.
Well, the right way to do it is, you know, do your homework, learn the terminology a little bit, get some practice. With beer specifically, if you can go at least watch a friend homebrew or make a batch yourself or just go to the homebrew shop and smell the malt, you know, or buy a bunch of different kinds of malt, buy like half a dozen different kinds of malt and bring them home and just start tasting them, smelling them, learn those ingredients. It'll really open your eyes to some of the flavors you're going to find in beer. So that's a really useful thing. Next thing, get a beer, pour it into a glass. I like to use a little white wine glass with a kind of a curved in. You know, it's narrower at the top than it is in the middle. Fill it about a half full that's a pretty good one. Those are great. Those Belgian glasses are great.
Belgian glass, yeah.
Any kind of Belgian, you know, really any kind of sort of more or less wine glass type of glass is great. Fill it less than half full. Give it, swirl it around. If it's ice cold, you want to put your hand on there and let it warm up a little bit. No beer really has a lot of aroma when it's super cold. And the first thing you want to do is you want to put it on the desk and get your nose about a foot away or 18 inches away from it and give it a little bit of a swirl. Can you smell anything? If that's a New England IPA properly made, you should be smelling hops by now, mm-hmm. right? A lot of those like nice tropical aromas, those are sulfur molecules. They're really volatile. They're going to jump right out of that glass. Some molecules are actually easier to taste at a distance than they are when you get your nose in the glass and take a good sniff, because there's this thing called habituation. And habituation means that our noses are not continuous. They only really fire signals to the brain when there's a change in state. And because our brain has a lot of stuff to do, once we've picked up an aroma and we fed that information up to our emotional system and hopefully up a little bit further up than that and made some judgment about it, and take an action, we don't need that information anymore. It's kind of useless. So our brain just switches it off. And so some chemicals are really good at that. Really, really light, volatile molecules are the ones that, some of the ones that habituate the fastest. And so what that means is you can smell like a skunky beer. You can smell that better on the table than you can if you bring it up to your nose and really sniff it. Because if you do that, you're going to saturate right away and you'll stop smelling skunky. So the next thing you do, so you can smell something fine. If you can't, you can't. So get it up to your nose. Or next thing you do, you don't get it up to your nose. You just take the glass in front of you, and you kind of sort of walk it past your nose a little bit. We call it a drive-by. You sort of swirl it around a little bit as you taste, and just like run it, like don't really linger on it, but just run it by. And again, we're trying to see if there's any kind of chemicals in there that we might be able to smell that are really delicate and short-lived, and we habituate to them rapidly. And you may, for example, a DMS is a chemical that might be one of those things that smells like creamed corn. And then next thing you do, get the glass up to your nose, give it a couple of quick sniffs, think about it, swirl it. If you're having trouble getting anything out of it, again, make sure it's warm enough. You got a big imperial stout and it's ice cold. You're not going to get much out of it. So get your hand on that glass, warm up the glass, swirl it. You can put your other hand on top of the glass to kind of cover it up to hold the aromas in. Swirl it around, then pull that off and give it a smell. And then the next thing you want to do is get it in your mouth. You want to taste. Put it in your mouth. Don't be in a hurry to swallow. In wine, they do this thing called chewing their wine. So you put it in your mouth and you do like,
Yeah, swish it around like mouthwash or something.
Mouthwash, yeah. You're trying to get some of that beer on all over the inside of your mouth. You got taste buds all over in there. And also, when you put it on that nice warm skin, now you've got a lot more surface area that's going to volatilize these aromatic molecules. And so you're going to have an easier time picking them up. So go ahead and swallow. Then you want to close your lips and breathe gently out through your nose. And that's something called the retronasal taste. And the retronasal taste, your brain has airflow sensors, or your, not your brain, your nasal cavity has airflow sensors. So your brain knows which direction the wind is blowing. And when the aromas are coming from the back of the throat, it switches into a slightly different mode of action that's more about flavor than it is about pure aroma. It's more about familiarity. It's more about preference. So that's a whole different way to experience things. And also, there are chemicals in your mouth. There are chemicals in beer called glycosides that are aroma molecules that are bound to sugar molecules. And as long as they're bound together, they're not volatile. But when they hit your mouth, you have bacteria in your mouth, and also saliva has enzymes, and those enzymes from the bacteria and your saliva are going to break those glycosidic bonds, release the aromatic chemicals, and so literally you're going to have aromas in your mouth that you could not smell from the glass, right? And so again, that retronasal is super important. It combines all the mouthfeel, everything else. The other thing, the final thing you want to do with beer is to pay attention to that mouthfeel. Is it creamy? Is it slick? Is it oily? Is it dry? Is it crisp? Is it tart? Is it tannic? You know, what's the general aspect of it? If a beer is unpleasant and harsh, it's going to be so really right at the end of the taste. A beer will always taste kind of nice and sweet at the beginning, but at the end, everything else goes away, goes out of your mouth, and you're left with whatever's sitting on your tongue. And that may be pleasant or it may not be pleasant. So for me, that's always a really important measure of quality, is to give that one last bit of your attention to kind of determine what that finish is like.
And you mentioned sometimes it takes time for the higher level patterns to develop too, right?
You mean intensity?
When you're trying to get the overall flavor perception, it sometimes changes over time as you're going through this process.
Yeah, I mean, you want to give it a few sips. Generally, with, you know, like people always ask me, oh, you judge beer, you must be drunk. Well, no, not really, because you don't really need, you know, probably you need about a quarter of an ounce, half an ounce to do justice to a beer. Sometimes you drink a little more because occasionally there are really nice ones in the competition. So, you know, you don't really want to rush through it. Take your time. And then again, pay attention to that finish on there. And, give it a good evaluation. It does help to write stuff down. If you're trying to learn to do this, get a score sheet from BJCP or find the GABF score sheet, or I've got some on my website that's just like a general, not a competition score sheet, but it helps to kind of have a little structure to be forced to think about the aroma, the flavor, the aftertaste, the texture, the appearance, all of that stuff, and have sheets that kind of prompt you through. And again, the act of thinking about it, writing it down, reading it, you know, if you just crumple your notes up and throw them away, you've already done a lot of good just by doing it. So it helps you organize. It helps you get some practice doing that. So I would recommend that if you don't mind looking like a total geek out in public, or you can do it in the private of your own home bar room.
Well, thank you, Randy. We're running low on time, but I really, really do appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Brad. Anytime. I love doing this.
And again, today my guest was Randy Mosher. He's the author of Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer, and partner in two Chicago area breweries. Thanks again, Randy.
Thank you, Brad.
Well, a big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to our sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for homebrewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide pump today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 software is available now for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool op options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.